in recent years, there have been a whole lot of studies looking at exactly why there are so very many different kinds of insects, and specifically of beetles, and particularly why are some lineages way more diverse than others. And these recent studies in the last few decades have all come to surprisingly the same conclusion, which is that it's angiosperms. And I'm thinking here specifically of Ryan Farrell's very well-known study that argued that there have been repeated evolutions of really specialized phytophagy within beetles, and that accounts for these gigantic radiations that have given us about 50% of the species of Coleoptera in the world. And that's pretty cool, and that's good for weevils, but I want to ask, what about the other 50%? How does the other half live? Especially when you have super diverse groups like the Staphylinoidea, which is a humongous group, very few of which are phytophagous at all whatsoever. Most of them are carrion feeders, fungus feeders, and scavengers. And you know, you can't co-evolve the dead shrew. So what are the possible evolutionary determinants of diversity in these groups? And if you're going to ask that kind of question, you'd want to look at a group that's monophyletic, that's not too colossally humongous, so not Staphylinidae. That's not phytophagous at all, preferably, but still really ecologically diverse, and that has an uneven distribution of diversity, so it contains clades of many different sizes. You can see where I'm going with this. Let's talk about Liotids. These charming beetles are a medium-sized family of staphylinoids that are found all over the world. They're known as the small or the round fungus beetles, but they're not all fungus-feeding. They also include carrion-feeding species, and they feed on a whole variety of different kinds of fungus to boot. They're best recognized by this interrupted five-segmented antennal club, which has been inconsiderately lost several times within the family, which is one of the things that gives them this reputation as being these horrible little round beetles that are really hard to identify. The current classification, which is was mercifully completed before I started my PhD, is that of Al Newton, who organized the family into 19 tribes and 6 subfamilies. And I want to give you a very, very quick overview of the ecological diversity within this group, which you might not be aware of. So the Liodines here, classic Liotids, this includes social insect nest inquilines, a whole lot of fungus feeders, and some very highly specialized myxomycete feeders. The Colonines, which are a largely enigmatic subterranean, probably fungus-feeding group. The Colovines, this is by far the largest group in all of Liotidae. These guys are mostly carrion feeders and mammal and social insect nest inquilines, and there's a humongous group, the Leptodurini, which is a tribe of highly specialized cave dwellers in Europe. There's another cave ecomorph that we see in the subfamily of the Cataphosurini. These guys are eyeless and wingless, and again, you see they've inconsiderately lost that interrupted eighth antennomere, which makes them a little hard to initially perhaps recognize as Liotids. The Platycillines are all ectoparasites and nest parasites of aquatic mammals. Platycillus up there is an ectoparasite of beavers. And Sylphocillus is associated with the Desman, which is a species of aquatic mole from Europe and one of the weirdest animals I've ever seen in my life. And lastly, we have the subfamily Camiurini, which is where we stick all of the leftover Liotids that don't really fit anywhere else. This entire subfamily is purely austral. They're restricted to south temperate habitats in the southern hemisphere. And it's almost certainly not monophyletic. Of course, this is the group that I chose to work on for my PhD because somebody had to do it. Sort of the same altruistic motivations that a phylactery worker might have. In any case, this slide gives you the impression that this group is all kind of drab and oblong and uniformly brown. I want to assure you that they actually come in many striking shades of brown. This is the tribe of Giardini that my most detailed taxonomic work is focusing on. So just to sort of sum up, Liotids are really a great group to look at patterns of diversification in non-phytophagous beetles. My dissertation research is really sort of a two-pronged approach to figuring out what the heck is going on with the subfamily Camiurini. So I'm doing some detailed monographic work within the tribe of Giardini, but then I also thought it would be a good idea to sort of tackle the Liotids from the other direction, looking at the entire phylogeny to try to test whether or not Camiurines are monophyletic at all, which almost certainly they're not, but we need to rigorously test that. I also want to look at some of the possible Liotid radiations and see if I can identify sort of common ecological factors that might be associated with high levels of diversity within non-phytophagous beetles, and see if we can extrapolate anything from that to other groups of fungus-feeding and scavenging beetles. So the first step to doing molecular phylogeny of Liotidae is to get the Liotids in the first place, and frankly this is the hardest part. I want to take a moment to say thanks a whole bunch to folks like Mike Catarino and Alan Margaret, and especially to Mike Ivey, who not only personally wrangled a dead beaver for me, but also bravely sent his graduate students into ice caves to retrieve Glossica vicola. So I owe a lot to the collaborators who have provided me with material as well. As a result, I have a really good sampling. I've got great representatives of all of the six subfamilies, 16 of the 19 tribes, and with especially heavy sampling within the Camurines, because again, we're pretty sure they're not monophyletic, so we don't want to make any assumptions about which genera might best represent those lineages. Because we can't all be the whiting lab, I only have a sample set of three genes that I sequenced for my molecular phylogenetic work. That's arginine kinase, cytochrome oxidase, subunits 1 and 2, as well as 28S. I align my data with Clustal and then fixed it by eye, because Clustal does a lot of weird things to your alignment, and performed some exploratory analyses of each of the genes individually using parsimony and fast likelihood searches. After I determined that each of the genes were supporting not grossly dissimilar topologies, I partitioned them by codon position for the coding genes and roughly by structure for 20GetS, and ran each partition through a model test to determine whether they could all be analyzed with similar models, and then performed multiple searches in RaxML. RaxML is a really fast likelihood program, and so that's great for getting, you know, quick answers, but with all likelihood programs, you want to run multiple searches so as not to get stuck in a local optimum with your data. The results of my combined data set are shown here. I know you probably can't read all the taxon names, but I want you to notice that we find a pretty good support for seven major monophyletic groups, and I've highlighted those so you can see them a little bit better here. You notice that, let's see if I can operate the mouse, there we go. First of all, the platycellines as beaver parasites fall out within the liodines. This is really interesting because frankly, they have an occipital crest and habitats that suggest that they, you know, you think they'd be associated with the colophines, but all of the independent data sets, as well as the combined data set, all recovered platycellini within the liodines, which is interesting. We got monophyletic liodini, monophyletic colophini down here, including the leptodurines, and a grossly paraphyletic camurini, which surprises no one. So let's return to those three major questions that I want to ask with my phylogeny. So are the Camurines monophyletic? No, not at all, not even remotely. The most grossly polyphyletic group is the Neopelodopines, which may or may not be sister to the rest of the Liotids. But we do see some strong geographic signal here with the Atriotonines. Are there Liotid radiations? Yes, I think there are 3 to 4 major Liotid radiations. These are the Agathidiines, the specialized slime mold feeders within the Liodini. The nesting coline and carrion feeding colovines, the huge radiation of leptodurines, which are the cave dwellers, and then I would argue that the entire family Liotidae represents a spectacular radiation with respect to its well-supported sister group, the Atriotidae, which only has about 60 species as opposed to 3,000 in Liotidae. And with the Liotids, we also see repeated shifts from apparently fungus-feeding ancestors to cave dwellers, highly specialized troglodytes, social insecting colines, and a mammal nesting colline. So what we're probably looking at is a move to feeding on fungus to feeding on fungus within nests of social insects and mammals. And what can we extrapolate from this to other groups of fungus-feeding beetles? Well, it looks like you can be a specialist without being a species-specific specialist. So again, I'm thinking here of the Agathidiines, which feed on slime molds but don't seem to have a particular preference for one or another species. But you still see a spectacular radiation, just like you would with some of the Phytophagus groups, which are more specific. We also see generalist fungus feeding as a really fantastic stepping stone towards new and even weirder habitats. And we've seen this also in a lot of the other non-Phytophagus insect groups, including some of the cucozoids that we've heard about today. So what I'd like to argue here is that diversification in non-Phytophagus beetles is often largely based on fungus-feeding ancestors that move into new and specialized different wacky habitats. So I'd like to say thanks a bunch to the following people and some grants that supported me. And again, thank you so much to everyone who very kindly provided me with specimens for this work.